I sure hope you know what that is. That is Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin. That will be performed Friday and Saturday by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Without argument, the greatest symphony orchestra in the world. And it's my great pleasure to have a member of that orchestra, Bill Buckman, on with me tonight. Bill, thanks for staying up late. I don't know what your normal bedtime is, but, you know, thank you for staying up.
About the time I'd be getting out of, this is about the time I'd be getting out of a concert usually.
Yeah, so I thought you guys would be late night guys. It's a pleasure to meet you even over the phone. One of the things that occurs to me before we start to promote the Friday and Saturday concerts and the reception is that I've been to the symphony a million times. And
thank you.
And like many, many other people, I look at those dozens of musicians on stage, and I don't think that each one of them is an individual with a personality and a background and quirks and everything else. It's often seen simply as a unit, and that's purposeful, is it not? I mean, you play together, yes?
We do have to play together, and it's hard to kind of break that fourth wall and think that all the musicians up on stage do lead individual lives and have their individual personalities. I think that's one reason why many people enjoy the opportunity to get to see us more one-on-one rather than just up on stage at Orchestra Hall.
Well, there's no question. Just in the what modest research I did about you, are you, let me ask you, are you the only member of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with a B.S. in physics?
I may be the only one with a physics degree, but I do have colleagues that have degrees in biology and pharmacy science and geology. There are other people with non-music backgrounds among my colleagues.
Well, I think that's also an aspect that gives the symphony orchestra personalities, this mix of personalities. And you have said in a fascinating interview you did in Time Out, talking, you're so self-effacing as a member for more than 20 years of the greatest symphony orchestra in the world.
I'm up on 25 now.
Is it 25?
Almost, yeah.
It's also, you must admit, for a classical musician, as good a job as there is on this planet, yes?
It really is. I can't imagine anything I would rather be doing, especially the instrument that I play, the bassoon, is one of the less common instruments and really sort of reaches its pinnacle as a member of a symphony orchestra. So there's no other way I would rather be spending my career as a musician.
You said, talking back to my compliment about you being so self-effacing, you did a fascinating, lovely interview with Time Out some time ago. You said, most people have no idea what a bassoon is, and I'm quoting you on that. How did you come to that instrument?
Well, I started playing the clarinet, I think, in fourth grade. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and they offered some wind instrument opportunities to us in elementary school, and I chose the clarinet at that point. We didn't have a string program in the schools where I went to school, so I was playing in a band at that point. And the clarinet in the band is like the violin in the orchestra.
Sure.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got kind of tired of playing in such a large group of players, and I wanted to do something that was a little bit more off the beaten track. And I spent a couple of summers at the National Music Camp up in Interlochen, Michigan.
Oh, Interlochen's great. Yeah, I know a lot of people who've gone there.
It was an amazing experience, and I saw a fingering chart for the bassoon on the wall of one of the classrooms there.
Mm-hmm.
And the bassoon is a particularly complex instrument. There are
no question.
There are nine keys just for my left hand thumb.
And that appealed to you? The challenge of it
appealed to me.
Yeah.
Well, you can understand sort of somebody that likes physics and science.
Sure.
And math as well. And I just saw that and thought that's something I'd like to tackle. So I went back and told my band director I wanted to learn to play the bassoon, and I switched over right then.
Well, what about, I mean, you obviously had a passion for it and for music. Were you, I don't mean to imply that you were distracted by physics, but you know what I mean? It's like, well, you fall in love with the bassoon. It's a challenge to you. you don't immediately start to pursue what might be a professional career. You go to school, you go to Brown University and graduate magna cum laude in physics. When did the bassoon and music totally take over for you?
Well, it was about halfway through my college career, and I was studying physics with a lot of guys at a place like Brown who really knew their stuff. And I could start to see some of my classmates who understood the material on a level that I didn't quite get. And they'd make connections between different areas of physics that were a bit of a mystery to me. And
yeah.
The professor in the class would say, "That's a brilliant observation because it's exactly the same principle." And it would have just gone completely over my head. At the same time, I was the guy in my music theory classes that would be explaining all the stuff to the other kids in class. And I started realizing, well, maybe this is something that I have more of an aptitude for. So my orchestra conductor in college, I was just playing in the student orchestra, gave me the advice to audition for music school for graduate school. And the music school admissions offices would tell me if they thought I had a chance to do anything with it. So that's what I did. I auditioned at a bunch of schools and got into a couple. And a couple years later, I was playing in a professional orchestra. So.
You were playing in Dallas Symphony, and then you came here. That is a remarkable, remarkable, and I think lovely kind of career path. Thanks for sharing, too. We're going to take a little commercial break, Bill. I'm on with Bill Buckman. The your exact title is the assistant principal bassoon.
Correct.
It's not bassoonist.
I don't know why they leave just the instrument rather than the person.
It sounds cool, though. Believe
me. I'll answer to either one.
Believe me, it sounds cool. If you hold on for a couple of minutes, I do want to talk about this this all Gershwin program that's being performed Friday and Saturday nights. Gershwin being among my favorites, and I want to know how you feel about it. Whether you think, you don't have to think about it. I'll ask you the question when we come back. You cannot, sadly, expect Ella Fitzgerald to be at the Chicago Symphony this weekend, Friday and Saturday night, but that song, A Foggy Day, one of the Gershwin's big hits, will be part of the program. I'm on the air for about five more minutes. And, Bill, you seem like a guy, Bill Buckman, the assistant principal bassoon of the symphony for the last quarter century. You seem like a guy I could talk to forever.
I'd enjoy that.
You'd have a fascinating, yeah, I think I'll do that one of these days. A fascinating background and seem to enjoy the music. Is there any challenge for you? I'm not sure people generally on the street think of Gershwin as a classical composer. I certainly do. He's one of my favorites. How do you consider him?
Well, we certainly treat him like a classical composer in the concert hall, and he was composing at a time in American music when there was a lot more crossover between the classical and popular worlds, I think.
Yeah.
You can think of movies from the 1930s and 40s that actually had symphony orchestras in them, and I can barely think of any from the last decade or so that had an orchestra in them, except maybe for comic relief. But a lot of popular composers were writing not only popular music, but also trying to do serious music in the concert hall, and Gershwin was certainly the most prominent of those.
Well, I always consider Porgy and Bess an opera.
Well, it really is an opera completely. It's very different from other musical theater.
Does this present, there's a wonderful Friday night, there's a sort of the concert is wrapped around a very exciting kind of pre and post concert receptions in the Granger Ballroom, which is a really wonderful space. Have you ever played in there, Bill?
I have. I've done a number of concerts of chamber music and even just some solo things in there. It's a wonderful space.
Well, really, it strikes me the intimacy of that space is something that Literally, anybody who goes to the symphony deserves to see something in that ballroom. And people who've never been to the symphony, I think this is a wonderful kind of introduction to it. If you're playing Rhapsody in Blue, An American in Paris, Catfish Row, and A Foggy Day, don't you think that kind of program would be a wonderful, wonderful introduction? There still sometimes is that stigma about, oh, the symphony, it's too rarefied for me. I consider these two programs, Friday and Saturday night, to be the perfect kind of introduction to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Do you?
Of course, these are going to be programs that anybody can enjoy, and we do have to deal with that perception of symphonic classical music as being something only for the elite. But we insist that what we do is for everybody, and we want to share it with as many people as possible. And this All Gershwin program that we're doing Friday night and Saturday afternoon is certainly one that anybody could enjoy. And I hope that any of your listeners who are curious to hear the orchestra, especially if they haven't had an opportunity to do it before, will come down to Orchestra Hall and hear us.
Does that stigma trouble you at all?
It does, simply because all of us in the orchestra have a real passion for the music that we play. And as a musician, what you do is really meaningless unless you're sharing it with an audience.
Yeah.
And it does get to be hard to compete in the modern world. All the technology that we have and all the other ways that people have of entertaining themselves, it's hard for us to connect with audience members, especially since music education in the schools is not what it was when I was growing up.
Well, not what it was. In this town, it's all but vanished, sadly, from certainly the public school system. But that's why the symphony does a marvelous job of outreach, too. If you want to, you should write this down. It's the easiest website I've ever encountered in my life, cso.org. The benefit is Friday night. The concerts are Friday night and Saturday afternoon. And Bill Buckman, how many bassoon players are there in the orchestra?
There are four of us in the orchestra.
All right, you'll easily find Bill. He's a nice hand. You can look him up. Look up his picture. I think I put it on Facebook today, Bill. Well, do you watch? Talking about symphony and accessibility. Do you or other members of the symphony orchestra, if you know, do you guys and ladies watch Mozart in the Jungle?
I have only seen a couple episodes of that. I know others of my colleagues are big fans of the show. And, yeah, that's certainly the best example of seeing symphony orchestra and the environment of orchestral music in the popular medium these days.
Yeah, it's an Amazon TV production, and I think it's fabulous, and it's certainly it certainly humanizes in some very good ways, and some like, oh my God, is that person crazy ways, members of, in that case, the New York Symphony Orchestra. It stars Malcolm McDowell, if you need a star, and Bernadette Peters. You are happy with the symphony forever, aren't you?
Absolutely. I love the colleagues that I work with. They really are some of the greatest musicians in the world, and I have to pinch myself to believe that I'm actually somebody that gets to work with them on a daily basis. It's a real privilege and a real pleasure, too. It's also a real challenge because these are some amazing musicians that really keep you on your toes, and I have to work really hard to keep up with them.
Well, I think you've had a fascinating career to this point, Bill. I'm going to give you a buzz and get to know you a little better because I think I am a big believer in demystifying the so-called rarefied arts that, it's too bad I don't have $8 million and can take the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to every public school in the city. Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, it certainly would be, and we try to get out to as many as we can, but
I know you do.
Always do more.
You guys do a great job. Bill, it's a pleasure to meet you over the telephone. Have a great time playing George Gershwin Friday night and Saturday afternoon. And you people can go. The benefit sounds fascinating because a lovely singer named Tammy McCann will be there who does great Gershwin songs. Go to cso.org for tickets. Bill, practice now or go to sleep or whatever it is you do to keep up with your colleagues. It's a pleasure.
I will. Thanks so much.
Pleasure talking to you. Take care.
Pleasure was mine. Take care.
Take care. What a nice guy. He should have demystified the whole rarefied notion of symphony orchestra. We got to take a commercial break, then we'll get some news, and then we will talk about a young man. I don't know how young he is, but he's made his first movie. It's called Rockabye, which involves his being a stay-at-home dad and breaking his leg and all sorts of other stuff. So please stay tuned. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the great musician Michael Miles and his buddies doing Someone to Watch Over Me. Michael and I will be appearing at the Hideout, Tuesday at 6:30, doing our show, our experimental show in politics, music, and Rokogan nonsense. It's called Panorama. Go to hideoutchicago.com. It is a real treat for me to have in here someone I don't know, but I probably have been served drinks by. Do you think that's true, Sean Patrick?
Oh, absolutely. Quite a few times. Well, just a few.
I never did my serious drinking at R.J. Grunt's, but you worked there for a long time, and I used to come in there.
That's right.
And you've been an actor in town for a long time, and I got a fascinating email from you that really intrigued me. Talking about you having been a stay-at-home dad and using some of that experience, in addition to breaking your leg, to jump into the film business. That basically is what it is, isn't it?
I've been, like you said, an actor for about 20 years now and broke into the film game about 8 years ago, but I really wanted to start to develop my own content. The fates, got me, and literally I slipped on the ice about a year ago and severely broke my leg. And being a stay-at-home dad, obviously very hard as it is. To parent on one leg was quite impossible. So I spent some time just writing while I was parenting as well. So I came up with this.
How old was your son?
My son is 7.
And your son, who is now like a movie star, right?
He is. I asked him the other day, so, people are talking about your performance. He's like, I know. I'm good.
I know, Dad. Like, he's the 7-year-old?
He's 7, and then I have a 5-year-old as well.
Good.
She's a diva in the making, that's for sure.
Oh, God. It'll be like they'll have their own kind of they'll have a show like the Kardashians in 10 years called The Leonards.
We'll see.
So tell me, you're at home and you're thinking about a film.
It actually happened one night. I was laying in bed with my wife, all laid up, obviously.
When you decided, even though your wife is alive and in the film, decide, well, I think I'll make a movie with a dead wife.
Well, that was the thing, is I kind of took everything in stride and said, wow, I'm really lucky, A, to be alive, because when I crashed and burned on the street, I was in the middle of the street. So, cars were starting to come and everything like that, so I had to crawl home.
When was this, last winter?
It was New Year's Eve, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we had big plans, too, New Year's Eve night. Those got derailed, obviously. About a week or two later, I was laying in bed looking at my wife, and it all just kind of dawned on me that I'm super lucky to, A, be alive, but what if, the woman that I love, Mercedes, what if she wasn't around? What would happen? I mean, what would I do as a parent, as a husband, as a friend, as all of these things? And so it just kind of dawned on me that this opening scene. And so the next morning I got up, and for the next 2 weeks or so, I just cranked out a rough draft of this. And
Did it seem like, I know you're a writer and you've been in theater, but did it seem to kind of pour out that all of a sudden there was this catalyst and you said,
absolutely.
You know what I mean, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right after, I just started putting, my fingers to the keyboard, it just started pouring out of me. What would happen? I brought a lot of, they always say, write what you know.
Yes.
And so I was, going through kind of the big shift of, not having my partner there with me but still having to be a father and still having to raise my children while recovering from wounds and all of these things. And so,
in the film, which is called Rockabye, which is you just got picked up for your first festival.
Yeah, we just did. We're really excited that we'll be making our world premiere at the Twister Alley Film Festival down in Oklahoma.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
That's fantastic.
We are very excited.
How long a film is it?
It's actually a short film. So it's only about 12 minutes long, which is actually really great for a lot of film festivals. If you get into that sweet spot of 10 to 15 minutes, you can play at a lot of different places around the world. So that's kind of our goal. Our first step is to kind of try to get into as many festivals.
What is the opening scene? Because you people will, as soon as it's available for your viewing somewhere, I will let you know. And I'd love to write about this too.
Well, thank you.
But what's the opening scene? How does the movie begin?
Well, because, you know, we were faced with a limited budget. I worked with a great group called Fork the Man.
See, that's what a lot of people don't understand is even a 12-minute film is a costly endeavor. It's
absolutely
not like, hi, I have an iPhone, I'm going to make a movie.
You can do that, and a lot of
people
have.
Well, I know you can, and they're not good.
But this is true. So I got a bunch of pros working with me. They're called Fork the Man Productions, and they read my script and really liked it. So we teamed together, and my opening scene, I was like, well, I mean, I don't have $30,000 to make this movie.
Yeah.
So we did a crowdfunding campaign, and I said, well, let's keep it to one location. So the opening scene is of my wife and I in bed together, and you hear the car accident. And you hear, you know, our EMTs, you know, telling us. So you as the viewer, you're hearing all of these things of what's actually happening. And as that happens, we go to the morning, and we're both in bed together. Well, that morning, she's gone.
She's gone.
So,
wow, that sounds pretty effective. That sounds very dramatic and
very effective.
It worked
out really well. And so we replaced me with, you know, I was clean shaven and everything like that. We did it all at the end. So because I grew out my beard, we did some great special effects makeup-wise on me. And so I wake up, and I'm just an absolute mess. And I have to make breakfast for my children. And
you have in the film, which again is Rockabye, two kids. Are they both played by your kids?
Well, my son Jack does play my son in it. It's actually his first pretty big speaking role. And then my daughter was very hesitant in doing it because she was 4 at the time.
She has no illusions.
She'd rather watch TV and, you know, play with
dolls.
Elsa is her hero. So we got this really wonderful actress named Samantha Jolloway, and she came on board, and they almost look like twins. So we kind of started, you know, looking at that as like, wow, what if we had these children that were really close in age and they look almost like brother and sister?
Now, even though Jack now is pretty sort of full of himself as an actor,
he's a pretty humble guy most of the time.
What was he like to work with?
He was actually great.
Did he enjoy it?
He did. You know, I mean, after a while, he wasn't really used to the whole process of, you know, doing multiple takes and having to do
it. Dad, it's going to be a 12-minute movie. Why is it taking 10 days?
Well, and that was the thing, too, is we shot his scene at breakfast time, and he hadn't actually eaten breakfast. So a lot of his acting was pretty dead on.
Real to life.
Yeah, absolutely. So after, you know, our director, David Bradburn, decided, okay, if I can get one more out of him. And sure enough, that was the one where he's just like a mess. And sure enough, he nailed it. David looks at me and he's like, he nailed it. He was amazing. I was like, go get as many donuts as you want. Go to town, my friend.
You're spoiling this young actor.
Yes.
I'm talking to Sean Patrick Leonard about his first film called Rockabye, which is it got its first entry into a film festival, and it will get in more. We got to take a short commercial break. I'll come back and talk some more to him. This is the beginning of – it's also – you started a, you know, kind of foundation as well.
Well, we've teamed with a wonderful charity called Buddy's Place.
You're my kind of filmmaker, Sean. You really are. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. I'm talking to filmmaker Sean Patrick Leonard about his first – film. I mean, you've been in other movies, Sean, but this is your baby. Rockabye is a 12-minute short film that has just been received and accepted at, what's the name of that festival?
The Twister Alley Film Festival down in Oklahoma.
And you've got the film out to Dozens?
We've submitted to about 25 different festivals. Our goal is to submit to at least another 25 or so and then just kind of see where it goes, you know.
Well, basically, I mean, a film of that length, it's basically a professional calling card saying, hi, I'm the actor, writer, director. Hi, I'm the producer, filmmaker. We're a team here. You like our thing? Let's talk about a bigger project.
Absolutely,
yes?
Yeah. I mean, there are film festivals, unless you start making features and, you know, moving up those ranks, when you make the shorts, it's all a lot of it is about networking, you know, and meeting new directors and producers and things like that. I mean, this is how I actually met Fork the Man, David Bradburn and Kia Houston. They came to me because they were in a film festival that I actually hosted, and David and I struck up a friendship. And sure enough, you know, from that, he asked, you know, I said, hey, can you look at my script and just give me some notes and things like that? And he said, what do you want to do with this?
He really liked your script, right?
He really did, yeah. You know, and Fork the Man is great. They actually...
Did you write the script as a short?
I did. We wanted to self-contain it.
That's very smart.
I didn't want to go any further with it because, yeah, I could write... You know, another
90-page script.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, I think just...
And knowing full well...
An audience might just, okay, I get it. You know, I mean, his wife passed away. He's trying to, you know, can we do this for 90 more minutes? You know, David had a great idea of just like, let's just keep it self-contained. Let's, you know, I said, yeah, let's keep it in one location and we can save on costs and... I'll cast my family,
and so we can save there.
But we got some really great cast members. Like I said, Samantha... Anne Jacques played my mother in it, based on my actual mother.
Wow.
So that was always fun, you know, is like my mom
sure.
would come over and she
Are you a Chicago
out.
Kid?
Born and raised from Lincoln Park.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Lincoln Park High School.
Wow, did you
And then
really?
I went down to Columbia College after that. So, and then I've just stayed here my entire life.
Worked at RJ Grunt's for 17 years.
17 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
wow.
Great job. I was actually born and raised on that block where it is, on Lincoln Park West.
Wow.
Yeah. So I lived in one apartment when my parents were together and when I was young. They split up. Then we moved down the street and then we nestled to the middle of the street. And basically, that's where
I spend a lot of time at that playground right across
the
street.
Oh, absolutely.
And Lincoln Park Zoo, then.
All the time. So, I mean, what a wonderful playground to, like, grow up in. I have all of Lincoln Park to play with all my friends.
How did you get into the acting field?
Because of a girl, of course.
Of course, yeah. That's a way to meet girls.
Of course.
I'm going to join the theater department at Columbia College.
I was in high school my senior year, I believe, and I met a girl in my chemistry class that was the head of the drama club. So I figured...
Said, yes, I'm an actor, yeah.
What a great way to try to get closer. Well, it turns out she, you know, wasn't really hip to my jive kind of thing. So, but I got cast in one of their plays, and I really dug it, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is really cool. Cool. Then I got cast in another play. I said, okay. So then when I went off to Columbia, I was actually going to try to get into radio because I'm big into sports and, you know, I want to be a sports broadcaster. Those classes kind of didn't really match up with my schedule. Long story short, I took an acting class as an elective, and my teacher, Suzanne Thompson, came to me at the end and she said, have you ever thought about doing this? I was like, imagine me telling my parents, yeah, mom and
dad.
Yeah,
your parents always love to hear, I'm going to be an actor.
I'm going to be an actor.
Yeah, that's just what they love.
So she's like, well, just take another class. You know, so I took another class, and then I took another class, and then so on and so forth. I got to work with Sheldon Patinkin, who ran, one amazing mentor.
What a great man.
Him and Marty DeMott were like my two mentors. So I did all of, you know, their improv. And then, you know, just learning basic skills there. And then from there, I went off to I.O., did my thing there for a couple of years, was on a team called The Shawning, which was kind of fun because we had like five guys named Sean on it. And then from there, started doing plays. And then once my wife and I met and got married and all these things, and we got pregnant, it was, okay, I can stay in the restaurant business and, you know, become a manager or try to, you know, move up the ranks, or I can really go for this. So I started taking some film classes. I always loved film. And sure enough, you know, got an agent, was fortunate.
Well, then the amazing thing is, though, that the decision to stay at home and the accident you had, those are the two catalysts that have put you into the movie game much sooner than you might have been in it.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, absolutely. That only happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, my wife was at home for the first 5 years of both of our kids' lives because, you know, she was nursing. And,
sure.
You know, it was just a lot easier that way. And she got this really great job. She works out at Ravinia. So she took that opportunity, and I said, well, I want to see what it's like to stay at home with my kids because I want to be there and be
a
good
dad. That's a
great
thing. That's a great thing.
I also didn't realize that it would be the most difficult job.
Oh, it's the hardest job in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
No question about it.
But, of course.
Every mother out there knows that, and any stay-at-home dad, of which there are not as many. Did you find there are not as many as you would think there
would
be?
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, I mean, part of the reason why I wrote the movie, too, is that, you know, we kind of get a bit of a raw deal. I mean, there's too many times that I've gotten, you know, some other mother coming up to me asking me if I'm babysitting.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and things like that. And I'm like, wow, really? You know, no, I'm parenting, you know, is what I'm doing. And I'm trying my best kind of thing. So
how long did it take to shoot?
One day.
You did it in one day?
One day.
Wow.
Yeah, because of, you know, finances.
Well, because you're a professional actor and your son is obviously a professional actor.
Everybody came, you know, ready and prepared. I mean, our pre-production took, I mean, about 6 or 7 months.
Oh,
sure. We started in like January or February, and then we shot during the third game of the World Series. This year. So, of course, part of me was like, can we start at like 5 a.m.?
Yeah.
Because I got to kind of...
I got something to see.
I
got
to kind of check something out.
I got something to see.
So, but they were amazing. I mean, my cast and crew just came to play, and they just...
How big? How many people involved, cast and crew?
Gosh, I would say we had a pretty small crew, and then with the cast... Cast was only five of us,
wow.
And then our crew was probably another 6 or 7.
Did you shoot at your house?
At my apartment.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
So it was definitely tight quarters, which actually helped the piece out a lot because—
When it made it, in some ways it would make it more real.
And more claustrophobic. I wanted that claustrophobia feel of the whole piece. And yeah, there was a lot of like wires and things, and we had to crawl over each other and do things like that. But it was—
And Jack, your son loved it.
He did, and then he got to play his video game, so he really loved it then.
Sean, it is a pleasure to meet you. You got to come back on.
I would love to.
When I'm assuming after you get in a few festivals, then you might post the film somewhere. Or
usually, you know, in a case like this, you do your festival run, and then you may, I mean, if you're lucky enough to have somebody say, hey, we would like to purchase this, then we go from there. But if not, we'll probably, you know, put it out on YouTube or Vimeo or things
That's
like
great.
That.
That's great. Lady, keep your eyes peeled, those of you who subscribe to the Tribune, because in a few weeks, certainly by the end of April, I will be doing a story about Sean, his son, his wife, and his movie career. Sean, I'm so glad you wrote to me. I don't know why you did this. Because, see, there's a point of going in and having drinks in various bars that you'll meet.
And you've always been an awesome, awesome person to wait on.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Be nice when you're in these places. It will pay off for you. Sean, thanks a million.
Absolutely.
A million for coming in to do this, and thanks a million for making the movie. And
thank you.
We're now pals.
Oh,
we're now pals. Tell
your
son. Don't be silly. Tell your son to be honored and don't play. The worst movie star I ever interviewed was David Caruso, and I don't want him to be like David Caruso.
He doesn't like sunglasses.
Good, but congratulations.
Thank you.